really any comments or questions for any of the speakers, I think are open at this point.
How much did Hester Blumenthal learn from El Bulli?
So a point.
How much? What?
I think it was for 5 years running, it was really the best restaurant in the world. It was up in the hills above Barcelona.
Bully. But he's at MIT now, Harvard. He's now.
A couple of years out. Get around the appointment laws and not going to pay his staff. Probably that was some of the experiments we're doing now with his test kitchen.
With who? Blumenthal or El Bulli?
Both. But, okay.
So what was the sore point?
Well, the people raised that question. Where did the Parmesan ice cream really come from?
A question on the reward side, this notion, like Antoine was suggesting, of adding reward of food with reward of the cute little toy, you work a lot in cross-modality, child. In moving toward doing better that we have done so far in developing healthy food that people want to eat, what is there? What is the next step if we are one to make really a more sustainable and impactful impact on the consumer that they want to buy, they want to eat, and repeatedly? That's one. And then two is that on the if we shift on the risk side aspects of it, I will keep that part for the next question. But on the helping to design and market or whatever healthy food that is more impactful than it has been so far, what advice would you give one? And two, we have done a few years ago a study on the link between if it's tasty, is it healthy? And in the Western culture, you get an inverse correlation of 0.5. If I say that it tastes good, by definition, I would say, which you don't have in China, and we had done the same study in China, and there was no relationship. So how could we, playing with the senses and reward, be more impactful, one, and two, how could we get rid of this, in the Western world at least, get rid of this inverse relationship with health?
Can I say one thing? I mean, you know, from a sociological perspective, the problem with the Western diet is that, you know, what is usually just a relish, like meat and so forth, becomes central. Most societies in the world, you know, subsist on cassava, on rice, and so forth. And you know, the really sort of heavy stuff is not a central part at all. And so, you know, it's in that regard, because of emulating our superiors, who, you know, in historical times had meat diets, that we've, you know, as a result, become much too preoccupied and ascribe a central place to certain sources of protein instead of others. And really, there's you know, a way in which that's where the economic model has to be changed around. So that would be just, you know, one element, the priorities, the values. And this is an irrational value, the value attached to meat, for example, and all of the ways in which it gets coded with other sorts of inducements, fat-inducing inducements. That would be one part of it.
John?
Be a shift from the intuition that pleasure in food is in the food, essentially, actually, it's the whole experience and all the pleasure you attribute to the food actually comes from what's around it, the place in which you eat it. So, like, shifting the focus a bit from actually in the food itself to that environment, that atmospheric dimension, the forest calories in that.
I think that's a critical element. I mean, food is to be shared. This is the most fundamental thing that we find across societies, precisely that companionship that has to do with sharing bread, that is at the basis of eating. And our problem is that we have individualized eating to the point where, you know, you eat on the run and you don't spend time over food in absorbing the atmosphere. And that's precisely it. You know, sensations don't have any calories. It's just the food, okay, that is the problem. And this is where, you know, Charles, by designing more interesting kinds of sensory environments, in which to consume food promotes the kind of mindfulness that I'm trying to suggest is key. But you know, you linger over food, and you eat it in company with others. You know, these individual servings, and starting with, you know, perhaps the TV dinner, you know, that's where we came undone, I think. And that's a very sociological perspective. Okay, it's saying that the root of all of our problems now is the TV dinner, which individualized eating and took the society out of it. You commune with your TV set. And it's precisely through putting the senses back in that, you know, I think Charles's work stands for, that you can begin to turn that kind of relationship around.
The statistics is like 15% more food consumed if eating in front of the TV than the TV off.
Yeah, exactly. That's the, and precisely.
Lyric Isabel Maria, how does it relate to actual practice, what those guys are suggesting? From the health promoting side.
It's interesting because what you just said, you need to know. Unless you want to jump into a party and you just mentioned something very important about the socialization of food, and it's the first reaction that I got when you were explaining it, when was your argument was, have we became food junkie? In the sense that, and I would like to know what's the state of the science today on that topic, in the sense of how we, through technology, through the food system, through retail, through the course or the run for innovation, have we become consumers? People that are looking for that big sensation every time we're having a little something to eat. And if we don't go that far in the experience, it's a boring experience, and we're just being disconnected like an internet connection. And this is where I'm kind of, it's in my head right now. I'm still debating, and when you started by saying that you were on the other side of the spectrum compared to what Andre was saying earlier, I was kind of saying, no, I think we're both in the middle right now, because it's how can we find a balance scientifically between this more social aspect of the science, which is for me still science, and also the more fundamental aspect, especially on the brain. I think we need to meet in the middle. This is where I'm confused. And the expression that comes to my mind is food junkie. And but it's not quite defined.
What do you mean by junkie in your term?
It's like the constant quest for consumers today to be excited. Fat Duck, for example, main restaurant, number one restaurant in the world for a few years. And I wanted to try the restaurant. The reason why? Because I'm a food junkie. And I was tempted by the experience of being pushed to the limit by this new chef experience. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to control over this, but that's another story. But out of my own situation, the average food, the mangeur, the average food, the eater, where are we standing on that line? Are we always looking for the next big thrill when it comes to food? And is just enjoying a glass of milk a boring experience?
That's interesting.
It's not clear, but it's in my mind right now.
So we're trying to say that to find ways to make meals more healthy, more exciting.
Eating has to be, today there's a pressure for all the food environment actors that Isabel was talking describing this morning to make sure that experience is very, very exciting. Yeah. But at the same time, some products can't meet these expectations. How exciting a glass of milk can be. Broccoli sprouts.
Right, but it's a bit of a slow food movement, so I'm pushing the right size of the opposite to
that. To go back,
junkie, yeah.
Exactly.
Say that. Sprout and broccoli.
And part of that, as we were saying, is that we don't know how to taste. We don't know how it works. We don't pay attention when we eat as much as we should to really enjoy every single aspect of healing that food can provide us. So yes, I agree, like the movies or whatever either we're doing, we want to have more and more sensations and being impressed. I think too that for food is the same story, but shouldn't we simply go back to basics and have people learn how to taste and you enjoy a simple food, like a glass of milk or an apple.
I can just say, in support of France, the Institut du Goût in Lyon, which is headed by Jacques Pousset, he was enlisted by the French state to inculcate amongst the school children taste. And I remember actually once having just tasting bread with Jacques Pousset guiding us, and it was the most amazing experience. So yes, absolutely. The simplest experience, just about bread, it was French bread, but it was extraordinary, and because he drew out the sensations. And the problem with slow food is at the very elitist movement, but that was part of the French curriculum. They wanted to stop fast food by instilling in children a taste for vegetables instead of it. The problem was the children at home, and they demanded better fare from their parents, and so it became a major source of friction in the family, and the kids just wouldn't accept the food that was being put on the table anymore. But that was okay, that's what we're doing.
Joanna, I think, and then Maria.
I was just going to make comments, just having done a lot of work with some of the industries here that you mentioned. And there is a segment of people like that, which is a lot of people that, with the stresses of the day and living every day, let's be real. For volunteers, how many of us here now at lunch is going to have a really enjoyable meal full of sensation? Those are the realities, and that's what people have to fight against, is the society, the culture, and it varies from one culture to another. We see this all the time. Canada versus the United States, there are differences in the way that we consume food and how we consume it. Europe and Asia, so we have to be cognizant of what are the realities of their lives and what's going on. I had an interesting question, actually. I just wanted to know, John, from your work that you did, this hormonal effect, did you see if there was any, in terms of where people were from an emotional context or their belief systems, how that impacted their hormones?
Our finding in that was pretty standard. There's almost no connection between what people will say on a questionnaire and what their physiology is doing. It's like it's not accessible.
Well, it's not what they'll say. It's what they say, you never believe in it. Was there any depth, really, really deep in terms of what was going on emotionally with them and how that related to their hormone levels? Because we've seen differences. Not in the financial services area, but in the menopausal one.
We had three series of variables. We had the hormones of the traders, we had their risk and performance, and we had a questionnaire. And there was extraordinarily strong correlations between their hormones and their performance. There was none between their hormones and the questionnaire data. For example, if we asked them through a series of questions whether they were stressed by the day's events, the answers had absolutely nothing to do with what their stress hormones were doing. It's really bizarre. And it raises, I think, one of the main questions for the neuroscience going forward. If you put a rodent in an open field, it's not a good place for a rodent to be. And it displays all the classic symptoms of a fear response. It freezes, it defecates, and its stress hormones go through the roof. You repeat it for 5 days. After 5 days, nothing bad has happened. The behavior goes away, it doesn't freeze, it doesn't defecate, but its stress hormones are still through the roof. And you get this bizarre situation of the physiology is running. A rodent should not be in an open field. So the question is, if you could ask that rodent, are you stressed? It would say, no, I'm cool, nothing bad has happened out here, but it should be stressed, and its adrenal glands know that. So, in the future, you're going to have these situations where the physiology is going in one direction and your pains are going the other. Which is right? If someone says they're not stressed, but their physiology says they are. Are they stressed or aren't they? I used to be of the humanistic sort that said, it only counts what they say. Now I'm on the other extreme. It really matters whether there's damage being done to their body. And that there is damage being done to their body. Stress hormones stay elevated for an extended period of time. So it's really bizarre that he's just parallel, not parallel, almost orthogonal paths between consciousness and physiology. It's troubling.
Maria? I had a question. I don't know to direct it exactly. Charles, regarding studies looking at the response or reward response to eating sort of like healthier type of foods versus, or healthier, I don't like to use those examples, but let's say fruit and vegetables compared to a McDonald's meal. Are you aware of studies that have tried to...
Sure.
Yeah, there must be.
Yeah.
And what are they?
See, that's why we say you have to fool the brain. You know, like there's a response to high-calorie foods. So anything that has sweets or fat, it has the same effect on the brain as an injection of cocaine. So so the more of that, that's the natural response to it. So a broccoli, those ones, they have a much weaker response in exchange. And that's why they're not preferable. Now the question is, because I keep hearing here, how are you going to make the eating experience exciting? And you want to create that excitement from the dish you're eating itself. What about reward substitution? If you want to get a kid to eat broccoli, why not offer them, the chocolate? If you eat the broccoli, you go to the zoo. You get a trip to the zoo, or you play with your. You just give them the non-food reward.
Why are you speaking as a hypothetical situation? That's what every parent does.
I don't think so.
Even within a tenth of a second, you're breaking the different things that are fat foods and low fat foods.
Yeah.
So you categorize them and responding differently.
You're
capturing your attention and what's going into your brain all within the first 100 milliseconds.
It's obviously a challenging topic because there's so many variables in the environment, there's so many aspects that are coming into weight, and there's just a moment I want to throw again in on the table on the notion of guilt. A little, the evil and the little fight happening up there, just to take a metaphor, my question is, what kind of physiological response do we get, especially on women, when you know that something should be offered, let's say, to your kids or even to you, and you're, because of the environment of this stressful situation, you're heading for the McDonald's happy meal because you want to ease the pain, you want to make peace in the valley, and there's that sentiment that is expressed by people that are saying, well, I'm not doing the right thing. They're not just hiding it, they're expressing it. They're saying, I know it's bad, but I'm doing it. My question is, when do we know about those biological or physiological reaction to that, and how that goes back to the Robin in the open space, how that is effectively or not effectively affecting the future reaction in a similar situation? Because my concern, and I'm not an expert in the field, from a marketing consumer standpoint, my concern is how organization or the food environment actors should be better dealing with this new psychological situation among eaters. Mm-hmm. And what do we know about the science on that? I'm just curious.
Antoine, you have done work on because guilt is a more cognitive emotion.
Can you frame the question? Because I must point that.
How guilt?
Guilt.
Not only expressed but lived by an individual that is making the wrong, voluntarily doing the wrong thing, knowing that it should be doing something different. Yeah. How the reaction, the body reaction, in fact, is influencing the future behavior.
Yeah.
Are we just going deeper into
guilt? If you see, these are two opposing. What we call somatic states.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the survival of the stronger, survival of the fittest. Yes. That is, if you're overcoming your guilt, then you're indulging into McDonald's, the next time you'll do it again, and do it again, and do it again. You feel a little bit guilty. If the guilt is so strong, then you have a negative winning situation. It really depends, how guilty you are feeling versus the force of how much you want to indulge, how much your body is really driving you to you had to splurge, you know, with
but
a big hamburger.
The learning from repeated experience is slightly different from those cognitive emotions than it is from your pleasure.
I'm not sure, because it's always about a net result. That is, if the first time you overcame your guilt, the next time gets easier,
That's the truth.
You reinforce the positive on the other side.
Because from a communication standpoint, guilt is a very important aspect when we want to leverage a product and its attributes.
You want to make it stronger, I mean, you know, it's a strategy that will work if you can.
But I can't
make it stronger.
Let's jump in. You see that in licensing studies, right, where if you get somebody who's on a diet to eat something hedonic that's not a diet food, then they're done. Then they eat like crazy.
Right.
As soon as they break
that.
Relax.
That's called the morality. Is it the morality paradox? Because we see that in toward the environment, that people who adopt high efficiency bulbs end up using more electricity at the end of the winter. Because I know that when I turn off my light, it's going to be better, I'm going to lower my consumption, so hey, I can leave the lights on all night.
It's related to what Anton was saying too, that you kind of break that first barrier and then you're done. Like, it's like self control is a barrier, and once you're through it, you're through it.
Yeah, I don't think we can rely on self-control very much anymore. There's not a lot of it left.
No, I'm not saying it's a done deal. That is, you have to work about magnifying the negative marker.
Maybe that helps some of that.
Until you stop,
I'm concerned about moral and this fight for healthy eating behavior. It happens to be unaffected, to be very moralistic on consumer, and that's why guilt, I was curious to see how guilt is perceived from a scientific perspective, especially on the neuroscientific side of things.
It's a much bigger. See, that's the thing. Everybody, you know, like the senses. Why marketers go after the senses? You know, that's not just by accident, because that's a very subcortical system. So both of them trigger emotions, except which one has more direct access to the limbic system, and which one triggers stronger emotion. Anything that is tied to the senses is very subcortical, and it does a bang. You know, it's very strong. Anything that is cerebral or rational could work, but it's working against against an obstacle. It has a much weaker effect. So you have to bring a lot of it to equate it with something as simplistic and as direct as
sense. I think that's why we have to educate the senses and make them more cognitive, which they in fact can be. The other thing is that dopamine. It seems to me we have to make dopamine more discriminating. I'm wondering, but with that word dope, where does the dope in dopamine come from? Is it dopes, or is it, what is the derivation?
I think the name dopamine came way, way, way before anybody knew that it has anything to do with drugs. It's a coincidence.
No, he's asking whether dopamine came before the word dope.
Well, am I allowed to have a question?
It's your workshop. I don't know what you're asking me.
No, because I'm kind of dropping in and in various workshops, and I'm not sure I'll be there after. Although I think that this conversation is just so important that I may stay. I'd like to come back to my friend Jürgen's presentation, the sand on the tip of the. Charles and Antoine, remember when we were at the marketing science conference in Florida when I don't remember the guy from the University of Michigan talking about the need of moving, because now you get all the consumer research on board in looking at self-control and what happened and on a one-episode basis. And when you look at the reason why I asked Jürgen to talk about this system level and this cumulative effect, this kind of learning over time, it's for two reasons. One is that if you look at repeated episodes from a health perspective, even from a body weight perspective, there's no signal there except that you get this cumulative effect that at some point you get sick or you realize that you're fat. So this notion of bringing in the marketing and consumer and whatever, the type of theoretical and quantitative study of the dynamics of repeated episode over time, I think it's very, very important. And the other aspects in terms of shifting supply and demand, when you get that I'm now not at the consumer level, I'm the level of investment that a provider is doing vs another one, what we need to realize is before there is the catastrophe that everybody wants to be healthy, there has to be accumulation of effect that you don't see the outcome at this point in time. And that's one of the important aspects to model, but that's also an important aspect when we talk about our whole of society approach, is that you need to cumulate of all type of action that at some point you get something to break through from what was a status quo. Does it make some sense? Because that's it hasn't been in consumer and marketing. Look at the modeling that the finance markets guys are doing. I think that there is a whole new next step, I think, that to integrate that bodily learning or that system level learning into how we look at consumer business and markets. So this afternoon, I think Jordan explained to you the context within which we are hosting those design workshops as part of this portfolio of projects that will be kind of capacity building for collaborative work on this one. It's about transformative innovation. And I assume it talks about some of the projects that were already ongoing, and that there is none so far along this mixture. That's what I was talking to each of you individually, in terms of both some of the more marketing response aspects, but also, and most importantly, the various aspects of sensors, reward, and something. So that would be great as the outcome of the day. There is one or two of those projects that emerge with fits with whether it's Antoine's agenda on combining reward, or whether it is how to move to bringing the census aspects of scaling up healthy eating in some significant way. Tomorrow, so that's the outcome of today. And if there is, many of you are here until tomorrow and the day after. So the idea is that today is not just an exercise in practice. It may be if you want to, but there is also, as part of creating this this roadmap, it is for really projects getting on and getting some capacity building in whatever way that fit. And within that context, Joanna, who was originally on the program this morning, she has been with us now for a year, I think, and they have one such project that is kind of ready to roll, and it may be good that we start with this and then the presentation and then the time for the breakout time as a function of everyone's interest, and I think from 5 to 6 we will continue together. Questions, comments? Alice, are you bringing up, not Alice, but Aida, do you have the lunches?
Just the lunch is the next floor, same place here.
So will we convene at 1:45?
Yeah.